are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, November 8th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Oh yes, ladies and gentlemen, big, big night last night for Democrats across the country, particularly in Virginia. On the program, Dave Weigel, national correspondent for the Washington Post, will be here to give us his thoughts. He was, of course, crisscrossing the country, reporting on political goings-ons. The wave crashes. It crashed on Ed Gillespie last night. There was a 32-seat swing. Erased, I should say, a 32-seat advantage erased in the Virginia House of Delegates. It could flip. There are four races that remain extant to be recounted. Meanwhile, the West Coast becomes a wall of blue. Maine votes to expand Medicaid. A night of firsts as African-American and trans women win big. Oh, and we have some clips of Fox News. Meanwhile, Donald Trump in South Korea promoting his golf club and nuclear holocaust. Back here, ACA sign-up spike as open enrollment starts and Trump okays or plans to okay things like work requirements for Medicaid. Republicans in the Senate and the House rejiggering their tax cuts as Donald Trump claims they hit him hard. So tough on me. CIA leader Pompeo meets about the Seth Rich conspiracy while his underlings say they're concerned that he's protecting Donald Trump.
What?
And lastly,
why would you be concerned?
Just to put a cherry point on it, what am I looking for? Ah, Syria has joined the Paris Accords. That's right, Syria. In between their long running civil war, they've decided to join the Paris courts. So there it is. Folks, an amazing night last night. And look, I pre-recorded this with Dave Weigel moments ago. I mentioned it in the piece with Dave Weigel, but I want to mention this again. We had some listeners who I haven't quite figured it out, to be honest with you. But they crowdsourced some polling, and, you know, they sent us the information. We tried to get it up and post it just on the site tomorrow, just, you know, or yesterday, so that it was there before the elections. And frankly, I was a little bit skeptical because it said that Northam was going to win by a 10-point margin, which at the time I was like, well, you know, look, they did the work. Let's put it up. And they were wrong. They were off by almost a full point, where everyone else anywhere was off by anywhere from 5 to 7 to whatever points. I mean, so the data is there. We've got a link to their spreadsheet. If you can, if you know how to use that kind of stuff or read that kind of stuff, then do so. Check it out on the site. But first, let's go to Fox News. That's honestly like the first thing I did was to switch over to Fox. And Sean Hannity was, they did like a 20-minute waiting for Donald Trump to speak in South Korea. Like all of a sudden, like foreign policy is so important. They didn't even in their scroll, their scroll underneath, didn't even acknowledge there was elections going on. But here is poor Tucker Carlson getting the news.
It is election day in the state of Virginia, the most closely watched race of this year. Ralph Northam, physician, VMI graduate, Democrat, at this hour, 58% reporting. He is at 51%. Ed Gillespie, former Republican Party head, he is at 48%. Numerically, fairly close, but Northam in the lead at this hour. Of course, we're going to bring you the results as we get them minute by minute. We've got breaking news here. Okay, we are now reporting that Ralph Northam has won the Virginia governor's race. Ralph Northam, the Democrat, beating Ed Gillespie with 58% in. We are projecting that he is the winner tonight. So we will bring you more detail on that. And if, I don't know if we can, Kristen Fisher is live at the Ralph Northam headquarters right now. Kristen, are you there? We're going to get to Kristen Fisher in just a second. I don't think we have official statements from either camp. But as we just said, we are now declaring or acknowledging the declaration that Ralph Northam is the winner in this race. And it looks like by about 3 points. Kristen Fisher, I think, is standing by at the Northam headquarters in Virginia tonight. Kristen?
There it is, folks. Poor Tucker Carlson.
Is MS-13 going to be in charge of law enforcement in Virginia now? I mean, it's a serious question.
He was so depressed about it that he didn't even have the energy to do that. Man.
Right.
I mean, now maybe his dog got hit by a car or something yesterday, and that's why he was so down, but he was super depressed.
Fluffles Eichmann got hit by
it was
a car.
Just three.
So in a bad
and mood. Then, of course, it ended up being closer to 9 points. But it was difficult for him. But he was so depressed. I wonder if, I mean.
Can we book a professor to
here's
talk
the thing.
About transgender people or something?
Well,
perk me up.
That may also be why he was upset, because a trans woman won her race, and we'll talk more about this, but she ran, from what I've heard of her speaking and have read, she ran just a very localized race and seemed to be completely on top of the issues and well-spoken, et cetera, but coincidentally, or maybe not so coincidentally, she ran against the guy who launched, in many respects, the whole transgender bathroom pushback legislation stuff. And she defeated him. So maybe that's why Tucker was so upset. There was a bunch of other reasons why he might be upset. Not the least of which is that if you are a Republican partisan right now, you have to be very, very concerned that 2018 is going to be a bloodbath, because you're watching people resign from Congress. There were two resignations yesterday. Granted, they were in deeply red states, but these are, and what tomorrow, yesterday is going to do is, to the extent that there were already far more candidates for office across the country than there were in prior off-year elections, there's going to be even more. In fact, and I'm going to try and find the statistic, and maybe I'll say it, but Alec McGinnis had tweeted this, and it was incredible. The number of contested seats that were in this race as opposed to 2013, which is the analogous year. Maybe it would have been 2015 or 2013. I don't know. I will check it out. In Virginia was stunning. And there's a lot of implications to that. We talk about it a little bit with Dave Weigel. But first, I will tell you this. Two nights ago, I got my first order. It was actually my second order, I guess, of Cameron Hughes wine. Cameron Hughes is, it's an interesting approach to wine. With Cameron Hughes, you can find like a fantastic quality wine at everyday reasonable prices, like a $50 bottle of wine for $15. And what Cameron Hughes does is he checks out top wineries, primarily as far as I can tell on the West Coast, but I guess some around the world. He blends them and then sells them direct to you under his label for 50% less than you would pay at retail. People know my sister is a works in that business, in the wine business, Italian wines. So she's a little bit, a little hoity-toity about her wines. Forgive me for saying so, Julie, but I think you know that I feel that way. And she was really impressed. And she also said the dirty little secret is that wineries do this all the time, but they just don't tell you. But that's what Cameron Hughes' business is. So with Cameron Hughes wine, you know you're getting the best deals always. These are luxury wines at affordable prices. Cameron Hughes has been featured in Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Wine Enthusiast. He has serious industry cred. And here's the clincher. He guarantees all his wines. If you're unhappy with any bottle that you buy from him, he will make it right for you. Find out why Cameron Hughes wine is the preferred wine choice by informed and passionate wine lovers. I'll tell you exactly what I got. You know, I buy in the $15 range. But you can buy wines up to $32 here. I'm not that type of person. But, I mean, I have once, maybe. But I bought...
Once? I want to hear that story.
Yeah, I don't even remember it. I'm assuming. I bought the Zinfandel Lodi, or Lodi. Maybe I'm not saying it right. There's two different lots. Lot 559. They're just numbers. I think I bought a Napa Valley Syrah. That was $18. And I may have bought the other Napa Valley. And then there was one Oregon blend. I can't find Red Mountain, maybe. That's what it was. I don't know, Washington State, maybe. And anyways, they're all fantastic. Really, they're great wines. I want you to try these. So, Cameron Hughes has given my listeners an incredible deal. You get free shipping on three or more bottles of wine and a free sommelier-grade corkscrew. This is a great deal to try these already discounted wine. Free shipping is a huge savings because wine is, as you know, heavy and very expensive to ship. The wine is fantastic. The deal is fantastic. Do not miss out on this limited time offer. Go to chwine.com. Use the code MAJORITY right now. That's chwine.com. Enter the code MAJORITY. And take a picture of the bottle, too. This is what I've learned to do, so that I know which wines I like. That's the way I roll. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Dave Weigel about this night, which is hard to know if it's a harbinger of things to come, but I'll tell you, it was pretty amazing. And there are some... a night like this could impact things like the tax bill, frankly. But here's that interview. We'll take a quick break. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's always a pleasure to welcome back to the program Dave Weigel, Washington correspondent for the Washington Post. Is that Washington correspondent? I never get your title right.
Just national correspondent.
National
correspondent? The whole country.
The whole country.
The big old country, yeah.
And you've been traveling around, obviously, quite a bit with the elections. So let's break it down. Virginia was a bit of a surprise, right? I mean, yes, right? It was a huge wave.
Yeah, it was bigger than we thought. And I was among the more bullish people on Ralph North's chances. I thought he ran an uninspiring campaign, not towards progressives, but towards like the person who pays scant attention to politics. They had this very, what I sometimes mock as like a Cialis ad strategy, which is some words float across the screen and there's some calming narration by the candidate. I thought he didn't run hard enough on his economic record as lieutenant governor, but there was this strange fantasy with a lot of people in the press corps that, despite all the polls showing him winning, the Democrat winning, that just Democrats are so hopeless they'd blow this thing. And literally, there might be somebody on Twitter who called that Democrats would pick up 15 seats and tie or take over the House of Delegates, but I didn't know anyone who predicted that. Just the size of this rout of people in suburbs rejecting Republicans, I thought Northam hadn't quite teed that up, but he was going to win. He ended up winning and then knocking over 20 chess pieces on the other side.
I will say that we had some listeners from the Majority Report who did some type of polling with Google or Android. I didn't understand it. We posted it. It had Northam up 10 points, 45 to 55. I put it up because people asked me to, and I was shocked last night at the end of the evening.
I did see that poll. Yeah, yeah.
I don't understand it. I don't know how to go into the tabs, but there it is. So. All right. Well, let me ask you this. So with the fact that even from your perspective, Northam ran an uninspiring campaign, even from people who don't really sort of make those assessments, right? You know, people who are just sort of not necessarily ideologically in touch or have any skin in the game other than I'm a citizen, I'm going out to vote. So what is the lesson here? Like, I know you have a piece up saying, you know, in the wake of Gillespie, can people run with Trump but not be Trump? But it doesn't seem like it. I mean, if Virginia is the bellwether, it doesn't seem like it matters what anybody does.
It's a good point you're making. If I was a Republican, if I was Sean Hannity, who literally did this last night, I'd point out, well, you know, Hillary won Virginia, so who cares? And I'd try to move on. Yeah, there are other states where most of the Senate map in 2018 is going to be in states that broke stronger for Trump than Virginia did. The difference is I had a theory throughout the last few months that just as Obama excited people and brought them to polls and defied projections, but couldn't really get people out in the midterm or a mayor's race, et cetera, et cetera. I was wondering if the same would happen for Trump. And I had talked to groups that were trying to turn out Trump voters specifically and struggling. They were going to the same rural areas where people maybe never voted or they didn't think voting mattered. They used to vote Democratic and they all went for Trump. And I was just skeptical for pure gut reasons that someone like Ed Gillespie could turn them into soldiers for him. I mean, I actually got really bearish on his campaign when he spent a week, and everyone hears the show is probably aware of this. He spent his final week raging against this ad that basically nobody saw from a Latino Victory Fund showing black and Hispanic and Muslim kids being chased by a man in a pickup truck with a Confederate flag and a Gillespie sticker. And literally a week of the Gillespie campaign complaining about this, they ran TV ads. And I had some Democrats tell me he should be running TV ads in the suburbs about how he's going to cut taxes, not how this ad is offensive. Because he was trying to get that kind of Fox News Trump, and I twin them together because the president watches Fox News. It's where he gets it from. This umbrage, he wanted to reignite it for someone like him. It didn't come off. People were not as enthused as the Democrats. And all of this is happening, too, while the economy's pretty good. Right. In Virginia, I guess that cut in the Democrats' favor. But you had voters who probably saw their 401ks go up and their wages go up and all that, and they said, not this. I'm voting against Trump. But then you saw people who, on their side, voted for Trump, haven't seen huge gains yet, and stayed home.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, what you're saying is that at least in this instance, and perhaps we're going to see this in 2018, is just like the normal, maybe normal plus a little bit of human growth hormone supplement off year election dynamic when you have a, I mean, I hate to say this, but at least for Trump voters, a charismatic a guy who's not on the ballot this time is just not going to bring out his voters. And certainly people are criticizing Obama, you know, in the wake of this whole DNC stuff for not being terribly concerned with sort of the party apparatus. It's hard not to say the same thing about Donald Trump in many respects.
It is and it isn't, because Trump has actually held a ton of fundraisers for the RNC, sort of ironically. I mean, he ran and repeatedly said in 2016 that he was going to self-fund, and now he literally created his reelection fund earlier than anyone else. He uses it to raise money alongside the RNC. But he made sure the RNC had twice as much money as the DNC. The RNC used that. They threw, I think, at the last minute, $5 million more in Virginia. So he's been trying to build them with money. And they have, you know, the staff didn't fall apart, but it was kind of just it's down to kind of college Republicans going out in the last weekend. It's more that it's just those voters who came out once for him. Democrats had this, I mean, you can't overestimate how much confidence they have today. Democrats had this unshakable fear after 2016 that something was just wrong, and they didn't have, there's some secret sauce in the electorate, and they might think they're winning, and then these folks come out and vote. The people who are profiled in newspapers every 5 minutes, right?
Right.
Like, I put on my pin helmet and went to this town where the widget factory closed down, and everyone thinks Donald Trump is the Messiah. It's like, well, yeah, those people exist, and some of them are disappointed how things are going, some of them are happy, but they're actually outnumbered. And one other point I'd make is it helps if your candidates are not subject to a surprise FBI probe in the final week. I mean, everyone hates when Hillary Clinton says that and complains about that, and says she's shifting blame. But I think that Republicans are thinking today, boy, we can't seem to stop talking about Hillary Clinton, but we're in a problem if not every Democratic candidate running against the 2018 is Hillary Clinton being investigated by the FBI. It turns out that put some points on the board for us that we can't get back.
Yeah, and so let's, I mean, just the in terms of the swing, where is the Virginia State House? Why is that so important in terms of numbers?
Well, what, psychologically, again, I don't know what to compare this to. It's, you know, 2010, people thought, most elections, there's enough analysis to say, oh, well, they're going to pick this up. This is the kind of thing that happened in 2010, where Democrats weren't even paying attention to, like, the North Carolina legislature, and all of a sudden, poof, it's gone.
Right.
So Republicans had gerrymandered this legislature for themselves in 2011. The Democrats controlled the Senate in Virginia, Republicans controlled the House. They literally drew this so that they could not lose it. And they went into Election Day with a 66-34 seat majority. Democrats thought at best they would maybe take back 7 seats. So, you know, tee it up. So they have the governor's office, and maybe they win the Senate in 2019. So instead what happened was in the Richmond area and Tidewater and in Northern Virginia and in Roanoke, which is not a huge city, but has enough of an urban center. Every place there were suburbs, basically, they broke so hard against Republicans that they just lost this. So functionally, even if they win every recount, Republicans are maybe they went from a 34-seat majority to maybe a 2 or 3-seat majority.
And that's if they win the recounts.
That's if everything that goes recount, they win. They may just be in a tie place. They don't really have a chance for the rest of the decade of being in that kind of control. And they just that's a level of that's a 10-year plan they had. That's literally one thing Ed Gillespie worked on. He was trying to elect as many Republicans to state legislatures in 2010 so that they could do this for a decade. It turns out if you had growth, one, growth in suburbs, two, a backlash against Trump, that you can wipe that out. You don't have this in every state. I think you're gonna. If you look at a state like Pennsylvania, which is less dynamic than a lot of places that were gerrymandered. Just, you know, people have moved out. There's not as many college-educated types and immigrants moving in. You might not see as much movement, but this suggests that, you know, the 1,000 seats Democrats lost in the last 8 years, they might take back 600-700 of them conservatively. And that just – that puts the lock on gerrymandering for 2020, or 2021,
right.
I should say.
That's
why it's important.
That's why this is so key. And so in terms of the dynamic, what we saw was people want to come out and vote against, in many respects, vote against Donald Trump is part of the motivation. And the people who supported Donald Trump, they just were not inspired to come home because Donald Trump wasn't, you know, on their TV, you know, doing his comedy routine and having people come out to support him. And so when you show up at the poll, people are coming to pull the lever for Northam, and they're also pulling the lever for the other Democrats who are running. That is that what happens? I mean, because I heard people talking about reverse coattails, and I'm like, are really the delegates that, you know, dynamic that they're bringing people out who don't want to vote against Ed Gillespie or vote for Northam?
That did happen. So Run for Something, this group Amanda Littman founded, which got a lot of press, I think deservedly. All it did was try to correct this impression with, I should change that, harness this idea after the 2016 election among a lot of liberals that I have been too disengaged in politics. Who is this guy? Who runs my school board? Who is my state rep? Why don't I just run against him? And it said, okay, we have a campaign experience. We're going to give you the tools to do that. Just the basic tools of how to run a campaign. They were convinced, especially when they thought it might be a tighter race for Northam, they were convinced they were helping pull him over the line because, you know, instead of just, well, you live in Manassas or you live in Roanoke and a Democrat comes to your door trying to help you vote for the governor. Instead of that, you maybe had a state rep candidate come to your house three times or leave door and you saw their ads. And there was engagement because that gerrymander I mentioned, there was a sort of learned helplessness for a lot of Democrats. They just, because these gerrymanders were so tight for most of the decade, they didn't contest half of these races. And Virginia's unusually great test ground for this because Virginia had literally enough districts, 17 districts, that went for Hillary Clinton in 2016, but Republicans had drawn to elect their own candidates.
Right.
It just was a kind of a pipe dream that all those districts would go Democratic. It appears that almost all of them did. And not every state's like that. But what Democrats have seen in other places, Michigan last night, I mean, I've been compiling all these races today, and in Michigan, the Upper Peninsula, they've got a district that went used to go for Obama, went for Trump by 20 points. It went for the Democrats. Went for Trump this last time by 4, went for the Democrat by 20. They've got these state legislative races all year that you've heard about where they, in Oklahoma, were three of them where Trump won them and then they won them by 5 to 10 points. They've got all these situations where it turns out that running for state office is not easy per se, but with like some basic tools and money, you can be in the hunt and you can catch a wave. And that was the difference for the longest time is I think a criticism of the quote-unquote establishment Democrats under Obama. But ironically, you know, this community organizer didn't pay attention to the DNC, and you had the DNC and other party organizations saying, you know, we need to, here's 270, that's what we need to get. Who cares about the rest of it? And that's gone.
Right.
I mean, you now have an active base that's going to try to contest everything it can. And, I mean, some of them will lose. One of the good candidates in Virginia last night was the one who ran against the one of the most powerful Republicans in the deepest southwest part of the state. The kind of, you know, it's like running against the congressman from Wyoming. Like, you're going to lose. But they didn't run anyone for a few years, and they ran somebody who won. In Missouri, there's a state Senate district that Democrats did not contest, I think, any time this decade. They ran a candidate. She lost by 8 points. There wasn't much more on the ballot, but they're finding, like, oh, yeah, just have the conversation with voters, and maybe, who knows, what something happens.
And certainly, if your neighbor is running and you hadn't voted before, you're going to come out and vote, and you're going to pull the tick, you're going to pull the lever for Northam because you were out there voting for your neighbor who's a Democrat. What also strikes me is that this opens up the door, and maybe this door has already been opened and people have already entered into it, but You had a member of DSA wipe out, I guess it was the whip in the House of Delegates. And it suggests to me that there's a lot of places where Democrats have not contested in the past, where people who are who the Democratic establishment would not normally support have a real opportunity to go into these races and be part of this wave on some level.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I don't know what the Republican counterattack to this is going to be. I think it's going to be raising more money to spend a bunch on TV ads saying, you know, such and such blogger who's now running for Congress as a pedophile or whatever it is. But as a reporter who's covered, I think I've been to 49 states, I find all the time people know who the president is, have no friggin' idea who represents them in the state legislature. And it just seems like people have figured out there is a opening there where you can have the conversation, talk to as many people as possible, and compete. Even if you don't win, you change the dynamics of the whole election because people are a little bit more engaged, a little bit more aware of this. I mean, and frankly, Bernie Sanders, who had this strange, people could try to rope him into the Virginia race in a strange way because he didn't back Ralph Northam after endorsing Tom Perriello. His group was founded just on this, and it has mostly been plodding through and winning these school board seats and city council seats and state rep races. And his insight was like, look, I'm Bernie Sanders. I have to my surprise, a gigantic positive brand. If I send out an email and say, hey, vote for this candidate for mayor of your town, then, you know, 1,000 more people come out. That's the ball game in a lot of places.
Right. And of course, that if that happens, you know, enough places around the state, those people are going to end up voting for Northam anyways. And so it's sort of a stealth support for that, the top of the ticket there. All right. Let me ask you this. Is in your reporting, as you're going around talking, because I've been to at least two or three meetings in the New York area to support races like some of these House delegate races in Virginia.
Yeah.
And is it your sense that to the extent that there's any type of institutional support or support that's coming in to help these candidates, is it coming from groups like these, like unofficial groups or Indivisible or Swing Left or is it coming from the DNC? Is the DNC sort of like behind the, you know, trying to play catch up? Are they involved in it? What's happening on that level?
The DNC is in this uncomfortable but interesting position where their brand is terrible with Democrats. I think when you see these polls where asked people what they think of each party and they're bad, a lot of that is that you've got left-wingers who think that the Democratic Party is corrupt because of 2016. And that fight's not going to end anytime soon. And the DNC, they're not stupid. They're aware of this. So what they've been trying to do is, one, keep their heads above water with fundraising. Two, mostly become like a toolkit for these people. So, okay, Flippable helped draw donors to your district, and Indivisible helped you find activists, and you've through maybe Progressive Change Campaign Committee, you've done candidate training. What we're going to do is, you know, help you find the voter files so you know who to turn out, and show you this text program where on election day people can, you know, roam around, use networks of their friends to say, hey, everybody, I'm going to vote. You should vote for this guy. So I'm being a little bit circuitous just because I know the DNC is kind of waiting a couple of weeks to study the results in Virginia and see what worked for them.
Right.
But they become kind of more, at the moment, they're more of a toolkit organization, which is more than they were under Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I mean, it's the interesting thing covering them around the Donna Brazile book, too, is that like none of them try to defend the way the party was. They just, it almost feels like talking to people who, you know, invested everything in Bernie Madoff, right? They're like, I put all my money there for 20 years. I never paid attention. Like they were blown away by how bad the party structure was when they just kind of outsourced everything to President Obama. So now they've got, I mean, I bet as a reporter, I bet pretty early on this stuff, you know, at least being interesting if it didn't work, because I saw it with the Tea Party. I saw, and a point I always make is, Michael Steele's management of the Republican Party in 2009 and 10 was terrible. They were getting smoked on fundraising by, of all people, Tim Kaine, who's running the DNC. He was stumbling and making gaffes, and people were calling for him to resign every 2 weeks. Didn't matter because there were so many activist groups filling in the gap. And same thing with Trump. They were brawling throughout the entire campaign. I think my paper had completely accurate A1 headlines about how the party was falling into a civil war. It didn't matter because they had the activists.
Interesting. All right. Lastly, any election that stands out to you? Obviously, we've talked about Virginia, but is there one that you were surprised about, you think is more important than the attention it's getting? Anything like that?
I think the Virginia House of Delegates races are the most surprising, but the suburban, basically this wipeout for Republicans in suburbs. I mean, even I was in Parsippany, New York, it's an hour from New York City, kind of wealthy community. It's always been wealthy. It's always been Republican. I was there, and Phil Murphy, who was going to win the governor's race, spent time campaigning for this guy who was going to become the municipal chair of Parsippany. The kind of thing, again, Democrats just never competed. It was, it's going to be a 20-point, who cares? We're going to lose. They went all in. This guy won. And same thing happened in the suburbs around Philadelphia. I would say that, and I'm going to give you like a 15-part answer to a one-part question, but I'd also say all the victories for the Democratic Socialists of America back candidates, like that 3 years ago, unthinkable, that people would just say, hey, I'm a socialist, I'm your local Democrat. People say, that's cool with me. So you have a DSA member, Lee Carter, being elected in Virginia. You have Larry Krasner, who's the Black Lives Matter lawyer and DSA-backed candidate, winning DA of Philadelphia, and you have a bunch, I'm still kind of counting these guys up, bunch of out Democratic Socialists winning in cities. So you have, it's that politics is a little bit more acceptable in the suburbs, and it's completely acceptable in cities. And if I was a kind of Republican looking 10, you know, trying to predict 10 years from now, that would terrify me. An ideology I thought I had buried with Ronald Reagan is thriving because of a backlash against Trump.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Well, Dave, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today. We should also add Rob Astorino got wiped out. That guy's not going to be running for governor again, I guess, in New York State, which I found sort of interesting. Westchester is not exactly the hotbed of Democratic Socialists.
It is not.
Dave Weigel, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks. I'm debating here now if I should just do a quick rundown for everybody on the fun half, in the free half, and then we'll go into the fun half of the program. I probably should. Just to wrap up this day, because it was a lot of stuff that was crazy. And we'll talk more about this in the fun half, but the interesting thing, and I would like it to be otherwise, but I just don't think it's the case, is that there was no ideological consistency, at least on the context of the left. There was really no ideological story here on the left. I think Northam is going to be, I may have favored Tom Perriello, over Northam, but I think in the main, he's going to be a pretty good governor in Virginia. I say that maybe partially because I'm predisposed, because I thought Terry McAuliffe ended up being better than I anticipated he would be. But, you know, we have a broad cross-section of Democratic candidates that won. You had a guy from the DSA who beat, and we'll talk more about him in the fun half, but you had a guy from the DSA who beat not only a longtime incumbent, but the majority whip in the House of Delegates. And when you're the majority whip, more often than not, maybe always, it means that you have the ability to raise a ton of cash because you raise that ton of cash for yourself, and then you have so much more ability to raise cash, you raise cash for other people. And then when you come to them and say, hey, we want you to vote this way, they go, well, I owe you one. And my understanding is that he He did not have a good relationship for whatever reason. I don't know anything about the details of this. But the story is that he was not sharing data with the Virginia Democrats. So clearly a lot of that support came outside of the normal channels, you know, probably at least in part via the DSA. But the point being is, we have a situation, it's quite clear, and we certainly had it in Virginia. In 2015, the Democrats only challenged 23 Republican delegates. This year, they challenged 54 of them. Now, Alec McGillis tweeted out, that is the Trump effect. And I think that's probably true, but it's not clear to me how many more of those 27, 28 are the Trump effect, and how many are also, frankly, the Bernie effect and the spinoff from that, right? Because in a world where Hillary Clinton is president, you still have a Bernie Sanders who is now in the Senate majority as, although I guess it's conceivable she could have won and lost the Senate, but unlikely. You still have an ascendant Bernie Sanders with an organization that is out there encouraging people to run, people coming off of that campaign looking to run. Nevertheless, certainly Trump has added to those numbers and has grown the different organizations that Weigel went through that are supporting people running for the first time. But here's the thing. Whatever that number was yesterday, whatever the number was of people who were looking to jump into a city council race, looking to jump into a state senate race, into a municipal race, that number is larger by 20% today, I would guess, because more people are going to be encouraged to do it. And here's the other thing that is clear is that because of the nature of a wave, that seats that weren't contested in the past, there's an opportunity for people who would not get mainstream Democratic support in the way that they would need. There's a chance for them to sneak in and actually win these elections. There's a really, and I don't want to say unprecedented opportunity, but pretty close to unprecedented opportunity. And the only reason why I don't say unprecedented is because there may be a precedent, but I'm just not aware of it, where everything is in play. And so you may get congressional seats that have not been contested in years. And it gives an opportunity for like organizations like the DSA, for parties like the Green Party, to step in and say, like, you know, nobody's challenged this Republican for a decade. And there's so much happening in this district just in terms of how many people are going to go out and vote for a city council person that has been encouraged to run for, you know, run for anything. There's a wave. And so there's an opportunity for some real, from some very unexpected wins and from people who are not, you know, necessarily traditional candidates or candidates who have traditional backing. So this is, it's encouraging. In Virginia, 34% of the voters said that expressing opposition to Trump was the reason for their vote. I mean, really, the key, I think, is what Weigel said. Barack Obama could not get his coalition out in the off-year elections. It appears that Donald Trump cannot do that either. And what is a little bit different is that generally Democrats don't go out and vote against, or people who vote for a Democrat aren't doing that to vote against somebody. And that's what we're getting in this off-year election. that didn't take a lot of effort to nationalize that race, right? I mean, Northam specifically didn't want to. Maybe in the last week he started raising it, and it was already nationalized. And women made the difference. I remember retweeting I think it was from Indivisible. They were sending, it was a busload of people from New York. And there was a picture of all the people on the bus who were going down there to canvass. And I think there was a couple of men on there. But largely, this has been the case since the election of Donald Trump. Middle-aged women have been driving much of this. They favored Northam by 16 points over Gillespie. Northam's margin is more than twice as wide as the margin Hillary Clinton won those voters by last year. Married women voted for Northam by 10 points. Trump actually had a one-point lead with that group. Now, of course, the key here is that far more Democrats came out than normally come out in an off-year election. I mean, that is the key. It is just turnout. And that does not diminish the problem with gerrymandered districts. But in this instance, you know, you can build a seawall that is 11 feet high and it will stop most of a storm surge. But when the storm surge is 12 feet high, then it goes over the 11 foot high wall. That's basically what it comes down to. In New Jersey, and so again, the Virginia delegate house, it is tied right now at 48-48. There are four recounts. Democrats lead in two, Republicans lead in the other two. Chances are that's what it's going to look like. It'll be 50-50. I don't know what happens, how that tie is broken, but it could be do we establish that yet, that it's the lieutenant governor breaks that tie? If so, it will be the second African-American ever elected to statewide office in Virginia, Justin Fairfax. But going around the country, in New Jersey, as expected, Phil Murphy easily won the governorship there from Chris Christie. In Washington State, there was a special election in a suburb of Seattle, maybe. Sort of a wealthy suburb. It's a Republican district. Democrat Manka Dingra won that special election. Her winning that gives Democrats control of all levers of government in Washington State, creating this wall of blue between Washington, Oregon, and California. And like we mentioned yesterday, governors of those three states are already getting together on all sorts of immigration, environmental, global warming, I guess, energy initiatives, healthcare. It's going to be fascinating to see what happens. Democrats added to their majority in the New Jersey State Senate. They won a Republican-held seat in the New Hampshire State House. They won a mayorship in St. Petersburg, Florida. In Georgia, Democrats picked up three seats in the state houses there and destroyed the Georgian supermajority, which is huge. Sheila Oliver won lieutenant governor race in New Jersey. I don't know if she's the first lieutenant governor, African-American governor in New Jersey, but certainly noteworthy. There were two Latinas elected to the House. Oh, and in Virginia, Danica Rome, who I guess she was a journalist, won Virginia's 13th District House of Delegates. We mentioned her before. She is the first trans woman to win, I guess, in Virginia. There was a trans woman, an African-American trans woman, who won a seat on the Minneapolis City Council. So she was the first openly transgender African-American woman ever elected to public office in the U.S. I mentioned that Danica Rome ran against a 73-year-old, 26-year incumbent. And he was the guy who proposed a bill restricting which bathrooms transgender people could use. So he went down. That, I don't know how much that played in the race. I have a feeling it played maybe on the margins, but for the most part, I think she just won because there was a wave and she sounds like an incredibly competent state rep talking about like potholes, talking about, you know, bringing Medicaid to her district, et cetera, et cetera. In Philly, as you know, Larry Krasner won the DA race. He's a civil rights attorney. He represented Occupy Philly, Black Lives Matter. He sued the city something like 50 times as a defense attorney. He'll be one of the most progressive, maybe in the country. We mentioned Lee Carter. One, Lee Carter was a 30-year-old Marine vet from Manassas County. He is a member of DSA. Just to give you a sense of what took place in Virginia last night, this is what took place in the Lee Carter, I guess, celebration party. Last month, it was reported that party leaders had abandoned Carter because he declined to report campaign metrics like the number of doors he'd knocked on and the amount of money he'd raised. I'm not clear why he decided not to do that. But apparently he said he ceased reporting to the House caucus after multiple information security lapses in which confidential information that we reported to the House caucus was leaked outside the party infrastructure. So I don't know what was going on there. But he decided, I'll just go in on my own. And I guess I should amend that. He didn't quite go it on his own. Here is Lee Carter, winning as a Democrat, member of the DSA. I suspect there's some other DSA members there because they started off his speech by singing Solidarity Forever.
So there's a song that comes to mind. Those of you that know, join in.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there shall be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. But what force on earth is greater than the feeble strength of one? For the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
Thank you, Lee.
Woo! That was a song written coming out of a strike in, I think it was a minor strike in Pennsylvania or Kentucky or somewhere around there in the around the 1910s or somewhere around that decade, and sung by the International Workers of the World, I think it was adopted, but it came out of a strike then, and it's become broadly a union song, and apparently a DSA a tune as well. So that happened in Virginia.
Kanawha coal miners strike in 1914.
The Kanawha coal miners strike in 19. Did you know that off the top of your head?
No. I looked it up.
Yeah, look at R2-D2 over here.
I was going to say, wow, Jesus. All right. So that is, I think we mentioned Maine expanding its Medicaid. Of course, Governor LePage is going to do everything he can to prevent that from happening. He may run out the clock until he leaves. There's an election in 2018. I don't think he's up for re-election. Whoever follows him will still be committed, will be obligated to institute an expansion of Medicaid. We're going to talk maybe in the fun half about how Donald Trump's HHS wants to put all sorts of draconian measures on that, but we will talk about that in a bit.
Listener Ryan writes in, says, a legislative tie in Virginia would not be broken by Lieutenant Governor. A power-sharing agreement would be worked out.
Okay. I guess that must be the Senate. And the Senate, the Virginia Senate, I think they have maybe a two-person lead. So this is all stuff in 2018 when one can anticipate. I mean, it's really not too different of a situation, right? It's an off-year election. There's not going to be a governorship there. So in Virginia, one would anticipate if this energy continues, Republicans have every reason to believe that they're going to lose control of that. And this is huge because again, 2020 is when the new census comes out. You need to have more control of state houses and governments by Democrats in 2020, if you want to impact the redistricting. That's huge. So, good night for the Democrats. There may be a couple other races I'm missing. I can't think of them off the top of my head. Bill de Blasio just eked out a victory against Bo Deedle. By something like 82 points. I don't think he came in second. I can't remember.
He's the first Democrat to win re-election in New York City since Ed Koch.
Wow.
It's crazy. And the whole thing is crazy.
Totally crazy.
De Blasio, he's just not very charismatic. But
that's right.
Plowing forward, got some decent stuff done. Hopefully this environment, though, will push him to get to 2.0. Like he was claiming, to his credit, he called himself a social democrat in 2013. It was probably the only other mainline figure besides Bernie. But now that there's all this momentum, he's going to need to step it up with some things like affordable housing, in my opinion. But I did vote for him.
Yes. Well, you know, if there's anything more transactional of a job than being mayor of New York City, the only thing I can imagine it would be maybe governor of New York State. Although
that's obviously,
but mayor I think is even more transactional. So, but
and
we'll
you have
see.
A lot less power. I mean, yep. People don't realize New York City mayors are hemmed in by the legislature.
The Constitution Convention was shot down in
that's
New York.
A good thing
comes
for
back
now.
Up in 2037. Yes, in my opinion. It's a good thing. If we control the Senate and the House handily in New York in 2037, I'll vote for it. If I can get my old, decrepit hands around the ballot at that point. Here's Bo Deedle. He writes, good morning, Frank Morano. I lost. I don't know who Frank Morano is.
I think the point still comes across.
Oh, yes. No, he's, I guess, the Reform Party candidate who did better than Bo Deedle. Good morning, Frank Morano. I lost last night, but I'm still a multimillionaire. You're, misspelled, Y-O-U-R, still a fat looser in the looser Reform Party. Also does not know how to spell the word loser. There is Bo Deedle's.
He might have been maybe potentially drinking.
Swan song. Well, but he didn't write, you know, you're a Seusser. He wrote, you're a loser, and spelled it with two O's. So, All right, folks, going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. I am now turning the phones on and firing up the IM machine. Just a reminder, we need your replies for the survey. If you are a listener of the program, you listen to the free show, go do our survey. If you're a member, if you watch on YouTube, go take our survey. It's at majoritysurvey.com. Click through the link that best describes your relationship to the show. Are you a member? In other words, do you have access to the fun half? Do you just have access to the first half, the free half? Or do you watch on YouTube? Click through that. The survey's 5 or 6 minutes long. Won't take you very long. If you want to become a member, become a member. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your membership that makes this show possible day in, day out. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Check out, we've got on our Twitter feed and in yesterday's podcast post, the link. If you are good with numbers, you want to check out those the polling stats. Fascinating. Also, I would add, check out last night's TMBS people, not the least of which Michael, are raving about the opening of the show last night, where they did this was just a recreation. It was not an actual audio of when Rand Paul got beat up.
It was illuminating despite it being a dramatic recreation.
It was a dramatic recreation. So you might want to check that out. Go, you can either do it through iTunes or, go to our YouTube page, youtube.com/Sam Cedar. And, we'll see you in the fun half.
C'est une poupée qui fait non. C'est une poupée qui fait non. Toute la journée. C'est une poupée.